Now, that's a dramatic increase, but it's also worth bearing in mind that in a population estimated at something like 50 or 60 million, the number of, as it were, government officials per citizen, or the number of citizens per government official, was vastly smaller in the Roman Empire than it is in the United States today. He also created a new administrative structure, a kind of an overarching administrative structure. He grouped provinces, first of all, into a large structure called a prefecture. Then he divided prefectures into dioceses. Parenthetically, remember I said in one of our earlier lectures that the Christian church was adopting the administrative geography of the Roman Empire? Here you can see that very clearly, the word diocese. Now, these regions, these prefectures in particular, were governed by prefects, praetorian prefects, who managed the great prefectures of the empire, and then by masters of the soldiers. So he divided civilian and military rule in these administrative divisions. Now, to address the frontier problems of the empire, Diocletian dramatically increased the size of the Roman army. His aim here seems to have been to double the size of the standing army, from something like 300,000 up to something like 600,000 men. He probably never got more than about 450,000 men in uniform, but still that was a fairly substantial increase in the number of soldiers. Diocletian is simply thinking about the problem of these long and exposed frontiers, and he's trying to deal with that situation. Diocletian, perhaps the least successful of all his reforms, was his attempt to deal with the economy. He issued edicts freezing wages, prices, and occupations. Well, you know, we can forgive him for having a poor understanding of economics, but, you know, within the last generation in the United States, we have seen governments try to freeze prices. We have seen governments around the world try to do this quite a number of times historically, and it simply has never worked. And it didn't work in the Roman world of Diocletian. Diocletian also accentuated the third century trend toward a more despotic form of rule. Pompous titles, elaborate courtly ceremonial prostration, that is to say, a proskynesis before the emperor. Some have said that what he was really doing here is enhancing the aura, the awe, the majesty of the empire, of the emperor, taking away, in a sense, that sense of magistracy that had marked the Roman emperors from the time of Augustus. Much of this ceremonial was actually Persian-oriented and taken from the East. And it's led some historians to say that the principate, the rule by the first citizen, has given away to the dominate, rule by the dominus, the lord and master. So if the awe of the emperor is enhanced, and his dignity and authority and perhaps power are enhanced, it's also true that he is removed ever so much more from the ordinary realm of individuals. He's much less a magistrate. Now, true to his ideals, Diocletian retired in 305 to the magnificent palace complex at Split, which he built for himself. And his tetrarchy, alas, didn't provide for an orderly succession of power. There was a brief, sharp civil war, and then out of that civil war emerged Constantine. Constantine ruled from 306 to 337. He again was a soldier. He was a man whose roots were in Britain. He finally sort of won out over his rivals, although actually he secured power in about 306, but he was still struggling against rivals for another 10 or 20 years after that. Constantine was a reformer who was in very many ways consistent with the work of his predecessor Diocletian. He extended, for example, the military reforms of Diocletian, who himself actually had built on some precedents by his predecessors. Constantine's innovation was the adaptation and deployment of mobile field armies. In other words, instead of trying to defend the frontiers of the empire, sort of with soldiers shoulder to shoulder all the way along the frontiers, he put armies further back inside the empire so that if there was an incursion along a frontier, the army could respond to it more effectively. Now, what we can say is that this changed Roman military tactics, it changed Roman military strategy, actually, I should say, from the idea of a relatively static line of defense to the notion of defense in depth. And it was, on the whole, reasonably successful, though its failures will come clear to us in our next lecture. The frontiers were very often now left to auxiliary forces, to barbarians, to allies, and to persons the Romans called federates, because they had made a foedus, they'd made a treaty with Rome. Now, once the army had been passed to citizenship in the Roman world, but in 212, the government of the empire had granted citizenship to virtually everyone, largely so they could tax them. So now the military service was attractive to foreigners living along the frontiers, but not necessarily very attractive to people living inside the empire.